Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, artists tell MPs streaming is threatening the future of music. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, I mean, this isn't a music industry story, or I suppose, it could technically be seen. I don't have COVID. That's the news.
Yeah, you were lying a week ago.
Last week I did. I wasn't lying. I thought I did last week.
Turns out a week ago when you were trying to get sympathy from our listeners that you had shown up to record a podcast despite having the COVID-19 virus. That was all a nonsense, according to science.
Well, it's confusing because I have been significantly and repeatedly exposed to someone who has COVID-19. And I coincidentally got a bad cold at the same time, but I've apparently not got COVID. So I don't really know how that's happened, but maybe it's just not that contagious.
After all.
Yeah.
Maybe they've been exaggerating it. At one point this week, you were questioning the science of the tests, because we had the theory, was it that the person you're exposed to who science says has got COVID-19, maybe the science got it wrong, or maybe your test was wrong. Maybe all the tests are a nonsense. That was an allegation you were making, albeit in confidence, earlier this week.
Well, I think at the time, I was like, well, how can I possibly be just coincidentally ill at the same time as living with someone who has COVID? But as the week has gone on, it has become more and more apparent that we have very different things.
So we can confirm, because there were a couple of people who are Setlist listeners who I exchanged emails with this week, or I spoke to, who were like, oh, how's Andy? Is Andy doing fine? So we can confirm Andy Malt does not have COVID. He made that up. That's what we're confirming here today on the podcast. Is that true?
I don't think that's how I'd frame it.
Anyway, you've been ill. Are you feeling any better? Whatever it was that you had. I mean, maybe you've got something that's worse than COVID, and all these COVID people, you know, you've got the real, I mean, the common cold V7, common cold 20. Enough of this COVID-19. Common cold 20. Are you feeling better? I hope I didn't have offended people who've had really serious bouts of COVID. I didn't mean to do that. I basically just want to find out whether or not, whatever it is that you have got, this mystery virus, are you feeling 100% as we get into this copyright law themed edition of Setlist?
I'm not feeling 100%. But I'm feeling much better.
Good.
And I was feeling pretty rotten at the beginning of the week. So, yay! Yay me! I've beaten all the diseases.
As far as I'm aware, because I live in London, not the centre of London, but, you know, close enough to be London. You live in the county of Kent.
I do.
I think I'm right in saying, I haven't really been paying that much attention to COVID news this week, but I think I'm right in saying that I'm tier two here and you're sitting in tier three. Mm. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, although we're recording this during lockdown. So, it's still lockdown. But yeah, when lockdown ends on whatever day it is, I'm not paying attention to when lockdown ends because basically we're still in lockdown when that time comes.
And you're in quarantine because you've got a member of the household who has COVID, so it's kind of irrelevant to you anyway.
I haven't been out of my house for ages. It's really weird.
The big news is that
government keep calling me. They keep calling me up and saying, how are you doing staying in your house? You are staying in your house, aren't you?
Well, we can confirm here on Setlist he is staying in his house. And at some point this week, we don't quite know when because we've not been paying attention because we're only interested in COVID stories when there's a music industry element to it. At some point this week, I will be able to go back to my little local caff and have a sit-down meal, albeit not of anyone else. But I prefer it that way, to be honest with you, because I'm very antisocial. Whereas you will not be allowed to do that because you'll be living in tier-free Kent, not tier-2. Mm. London town. Anyway, no one's interested in this.
I can't even come and visit you in tier 2 to see what it's like. That's not allowed.
There's a real party going on here. Actually, there was a party going on somewhere near my house as I sat down to record this. I thought we were going to have a backing track to this week's podcast, but the party seems to have stopped.
Not again.
The party seems to have stopped. So we don't have a backing track at the moment. But we're not here to talk about any of this. This is just of no interest to anybody tuning in, apart from those two people who did want to know how you were. So we've ticked that box. He's fine.
No one knows they asked you. No one asked me how I was.
Well, you don't talk to anyone. You don't even leave the house. We've already established that.
Well, I could have emailed. I could have called.
You are being very ungrateful here, because one of the people who asked me by email had CC'd you on the email.
Oh, really? Okay.
So who knows how many other emails there were in your inbox asking
Did I mention
you?
I've been ill. I've not been on top of things.
But to clarify one last time, we're not here to talk about any of this week. What are we here to talk about this week?
Well, later on, we will be discussing the legal argument over whether reels would ever be confused with reels. But first, the first oral hearing as part of Parliament's inquiry into the economics of music streaming took place last week, with four music makers among those giving evidence: Radiohead's Ed O'Brien, Elbow's Guy Garvey, Nadine Shah, and Gomez's Tom Gray, all of whom told MPs that the current model isn't working for many artists. So much so, said Garvey, that it is threatening the future of music. Now, we discussed this inquiry on an episode of Setlist back in October when it was first announced. But Chris, how about you quickly remind us what this Select Committee inquiry is all about?
Yeah, so this is the Culture Select Committee of the UK Parliament, and they have decided to stage an inquiry looking into the economics of streaming. There are various things on the agenda, but ultimately, the biggest bit is looking at the money that is made by subscription streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music and Amazon, etc. How that money is generated, how that money is shared out between the platforms themselves and the music industry, and then how it's shared out between all of the different members of the music industry. And this inquiry comes on the back of the various campaigns, in particular here in the UK, the Broken Record campaign and the Fixed Streaming campaign, which are in some ways interlinked, that have been gaining momentum online since the start of the year. And I think we probably said this when we talked about the inquiry being announced last month. None of the questions being asked in this inquiry, none of the topics being debated as part of the Broken Record campaign or the Fixed Streaming campaign are new. Regular listeners to Setlist, we've been debating these for years now. And of course, everybody listening has read from cover to cover, I am sure. Obviously, as we all know, with the exception of Andy Malt. But everybody else listening now has read from cover to cover the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book, which I wrote based on the 5 years of research that CMU has been doing with the Music Managers Forum. So MMF, the UK trade body for artist managers, have been investigating all of these things, debating all of these things for 5 years now, and we've been helping with that process. So none of these debates are new. But what is new is, of course, because COVID took away the live revenue stream from the entire music industry pretty much overnight and negatively impacted on some other revenue streams as well, but crucially has had pretty much no effect at all on subscription streaming. If anything, more people are subscribing because they're shut in at home. So that's the one revenue stream that hasn't been affected by COVID. But because of various industry conventions and the way record deals are structured, etc., etc., subscription streaming is often the music industry revenue stream where artists and songwriters see the smallest share for various reasons. And that fact has come much more back into the spotlight since March, as you've had a significant number of artists lose their live revenue stream, see other revenue streams negatively hit, and then they're looking at their streaming revenue stream, and in some cases, possibly many cases, artists are saying, well, hang on a second, I know subscription streaming is doing very well, but that's the one bit of my artist business that doesn't really bring in any money at all. All my other revenue streams, which in normal times would keep me making money for my music, keep me paying rent, etc., all of those have gone. So how come is it that even though I know streaming is doing very well at large, I'm just not getting my share of the money? And so that led to the Broken Record campaign, led by Tom Gray of Gomez and lots of other music projects as well. Then alongside that, the Ivors Academy, which speaks for songwriters in the UK, the Musicians Union, which speaks for musicians in the UK, launched their Fixed Streaming campaign. That then got everybody talking about it on social media and in the mainstream media, resulting in this Select Committee inquiry. Everybody in the music industry now has put in written submissions setting out which of these issues they think are most important, presenting the arguments for their bit of the music industry on the key topics. And we're going to now have a series of these oral hearings where different people from the music industry are going to come forward. And that was what took place last week. The first of those oral hearings. And as you say, it was very musician dominated, which, as it should be, the first conversation should be getting the artist's perspective. Although we did also have a couple of people from the industry, albeit people from the industry who generally represent artists. So we had the lawyer Tom Fredericks and we had the music accountant Colin Young, both of whom work for and negotiate on behalf of artists and songwriters. They were also part of this oral hearing. But I suppose crucially, this first session was very artist-centric and we didn't have the platforms there, we didn't have the labels there, we didn't have the collecting societies there. But it was an interesting first debate.
So we know, and setlist listeners will know, and anyone who's read Dissecting the Digital Dollar will know, obviously I'm not one of those people, but I know that the debate around what the problem is with streaming is complicated, very complex, and there are lots of different arguments that different sides give. But obviously with the artists and artist representatives speaking, it's going to be services and labels who are going to be getting the negative attention here. So who got the most heat, services or labels?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I suppose one thing to say is that all of the artists taking part were generally keen to stress that on one level, they are fans of streaming. They're fans of the fact that now you can access all this great music on demand and that there are elements of the streaming services that they like. Most of them also were saying, you know, there are elements of record labels we like. We recognise the investments we make. We recognise the marketing skills they bring to the table. They all have labels or people who work at labels that they like. So there was a little bit of positivity there. But yes, I suppose ultimately when of all the different topics that could be discussed, because it was an artist-centric hearing, ultimately the topic on the agenda was, do artists get a big enough slice of the digital pie? Do they get a fair share of the streaming money? And if we conclude that they don't, and most people on this side of the argument would say they don't, what can we do about that? Yeah, interesting question, though. If we agree, for the sake of argument, let's just agree for the sake of argument that many artists are not seeing enough streaming money as they should, then who's to blame? Is it because the streaming services don't pay high enough royalties? Is that because they're greedy? Is it because they're not charging the customers enough? Or is the problem not how much Spotify and Apple, etc. are putting into the system? The problem is what happens to that money as it flows through the system. And one little observation I've got is, I think when you have these debates, particularly when they're artist-led, they're coming from the artist community. And obviously we've had the Broken Record campaign and the Fixed Streaming campaign here in the UK, and there's been some similar things going on in other countries. Quite often, when artists and songwriters first start speaking out about the fact that they aren't making enough money out of streaming, for one reason or another, it seems to me that the initial target is the streaming platforms. And so initially the debate will be the per stream rates. Quick footnote here, let's not forget there are no per stream rates, but that doesn't stop people pretending there are. So people will say, well, the per stream rates are too low. It's outrageous that we get paid fractions of a penny per stream. The streaming services are so extravagant. Their senior executives get paid so much money. They've built these multi-billion dollar businesses on our music. Spotify is the problem. And actually, when the streaming services are in the spotlight, it often is Spotify who tends to get the criticism, I guess, just because in most of the world, they're the biggest. They're making the most money. And so you go after the big guy, don't you? So it often begins with the problem is the streaming platforms. But it seems to me the longer the debate goes on and the more conversations happen and the more weeks and months go by, the more likely it is we need to do some maths. We need to get someone to draw a graph. The more likely it is, the longer the debate goes on, but we stop shouting at streaming services and we start shouting at record companies, and particularly major record companies. And if my theory is correct, that means if you're a lobbyist for the streaming services, your strategy should be to keep this debate going as long as possible. Because the longer the debate goes on, the more likely it is that people are going to stop saying Spotify is evil and more likely to say, Sony, Universal and Warner, they're taking all the money. So to answer your actual question, I think really with this hearing, the record companies and in particular the three majors got more heat than the platforms. So it's not to say that there was no criticism of the platforms and there definitely will be more criticism of the platforms as the debates go on. But yeah, it did feel like it was the record companies, and in particular the major record companies, who will have to present a defence at a future oral hearing, because they did get quite a lot of criticism at this hearing.
Yeah, well, I did notice that one of the things the labels have said is that they would support the streaming services experimenting with price rises, and that does definitely keep the focus on the streaming services rather than the labels themselves. So I guess we'll see more of that sort of argument as this inquiry goes on. But in terms of this hearing that happened last week, was there one particular standout talking point?
Yeah, I would say that the big takeaway, particularly from the first section, so it was in two sections. So the second section was all artists. The first section was Tom Gray, an artist, but also because he is sort of the person behind the Broken Record campaign. And then we had Tom Fredericks giving a legal perspective and a deals perspective, and Colin Young giving an accountancy perspective and a royalty auditing perspective. And I would say certainly in the first section, the big talking point ended up being good old equitable remuneration, which I've now learnt how to say, because I feel like I'm going to have to say it a lot in the months ahead. I mean, just in the next week, I'm doing two speed briefings on streaming as part of debates outside of the UK, but basically following the same topics as the parliamentary inquiry. So I feel like I'm going to have to say equitable remuneration a lot. So I've learned how to say it.
Can you say it without the obvious pause in between the two words?
The problem is remuneration I can now say, mm-hmm. but because my brain knows that I couldn't used to say that word, because I used to say remuneration, which is wrong.
That is wrong.
My brain now is so getting ready to say remuneration correctly, I now screw up the word equitable. When I say it fast. Anyway, ER. Let's talk about ER. Even Tom, I was very pleased. Tom Gray, there was two Toms, that's confusing for the first bit. Tom Gray did say...
Do you know, I thought Tom from MySpace. Still, he's still there in my head.
No Tom from MySpace. Maybe they'll get him on the platforms edition of the inquiry. Tom Gray did suggest that we use the ER, because equitable remuneration is such a mouthful. So yeah, ER was the big talking point. So if we look at the first section, what happened in the first section was both Toms and Colin talked a lot about how record deals are structured, particularly traditional record deals, traditional major record deals, although quite a lot of what they said about traditional major record label deals would be true of deals with certainly the bigger independents as well. So they talked about how usually on a traditional record deal, once money starts to flow in from the recordings that are created under that deal, a minority of the money is usually paid to the artist. So these days on a sort of pretty standard record deal, probably the artist would be getting no more than 20% on things like streaming income. They also talked about how some of the label's upfront costs are recoupable, so any cash advance obviously needs to be recouped, but label may also be able to recoup some other costs that it's incurred as set out in contract, which means that 20% has to pay off anything that is recoupable before the artist gets any more money. They also talked about how record deals traditionally, and in some cases still, are life of copyright deals, so it means that the label will control the sound recording copyrights created under the deal for as long as those copyrights exist. So you did your deal in the 1970s, before streaming was even dreamt about. I mean, maybe you did your deal in 1998, before streaming was dreamt about. Actually, if you read some record deals from the late 2000s, streaming hadn't been dreamt about. So maybe you did your deal in 2009 and streaming hadn't been dreamt about for some reason. But you've got these old-fashioned deals that don't talk about streaming, then get applied to the streaming age, and maybe they don't get applied in a fair way, but there's nothing the artist can really do about that because the label controls the recording for life copyright. So all of this was discussed, and it was acknowledged that every record deal is different. So some artists will have much more favourable deals, certainly with certain independents, certain smaller independents, even the bigger independents may now be doing fixed-term assignment deals rather than life of copyright. Or they may be writing off unrecouped funds on very old record contracts, or they may be paying the standard 20% or 25% even royalty on old contracts as well as new contracts. So they talked about how every deal is different. And of course, we're in an age where artists don't even have to do a traditional record deal. If you have an entrepreneurial artist with a great management team, they can work with either a distributor or a label services company, or indeed a label, but in more of a partnership. So rather than it being the classic deal I've just described. Maybe the label or distributor's risk is less. They're not bringing as many services to the table. And sometimes it flips. So actually now the artist is getting 80% of the money and the distributor 20%. So it was acknowledged that every deal is different. Although the argument put forward, it'd be interesting to do some research on this actually, was that most successful artists have something more like a traditional record deal. Now, in certain genres and deals done in the last 5 years, I don't know whether that is true, but it is true. A lot of artists are still stuck in traditional record deals. And so then the conversation moves on and says, okay, well, every record deal is different. These are privately negotiated deals. If it was decided, this is still an if, but if it was decided that the way the money gets shared out of the artist is unfair, the artist should be getting more of the money, but the artists are getting their cut of the money for a record deal that was privately negotiated, every deal is different, what could Parliament, what could government, what could MPs do about it? Could Parliament interfere in privately negotiated contracts? Interestingly, with the European Copyright Directive, which obviously does not apply in the UK, but under European Copyright Directive, there is a thing called the Contract Adjustment Mechanism. We still don't really know how that's going to work, but it conceivably could result in copyright law interfering in privately negotiated contracts. And under some European legal systems, that is less drastic than it would feel like under a UK system. But anyway, we're not having the copyright directive here. But the other solution here, if you want artists to have more money, but you don't want to interfere with privately negotiated deals, is to say that ER should be paid on streams.
So there's that term again. So now you've done all that explanation, tell us, what is equitable remuneration?
So we've definitely talked about this on podcasts before, but just very quickly, ER is a concept that already exists in copyright law in most countries. Not all countries, but most countries, because it actually begins with global copyright treaties. So ER is a principle that says that when a sound recording is exploited in certain specific ways, the performers who appear on the record, all the performers, so both the main artist and any session musicians, all the performers have a statutory right to payment rather than a contractual right. So with most uses of music, copyright law doesn't intervene in that way. So it's all down to contract. So if I do a record deal, I'm the label, and I do a record deal with an artist and I say, I'll pay you 20% royalty once you've recouped blah, 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 then that is how the artist will get paid. Then we hire some session musicians to appear on the recording, and we say to session musicians, we're going to pay you a couple hundred quid for your time. You're not going to be cut into any rights. You're not going to get any future royalties. We do a deal. Okay, all of that is set out. Those are contractual rights, or in the case of session musicians, contractual no rights in terms of future payment. So those are contractual rights to payment. Whereas with ER, it's a statutory right. So the law is saying when your music is used in certain ways, the artist has to be paid, and has to be paid at an industry standard rate. So rather than everybody negotiating their own royalties, everybody gets paid the same when ER applies. So under current law, ER applies to things like radio, it applies to public performance. In copyright terms, basically, if it is the performance control element of the copyright or the communication control element of the copyright that is being exploited, then ER is paid. So artists get their payment subject to law. That is all managed by the collective management system. So the money is collected by PPL, the collecting society, and there is nothing a record deal can do about it. Okay, you cannot get an artist to sign a record deal or a session musician to sign a session agreement that stops them from getting that ER, because it is a statutory right to payment. But as it currently stands, ER is not paid on streams. And in terms of copyright law, that's based on the argument that a stream exploits the making available control of the copyright, not the communication control, which, I mean, the music industry's decided that. That isn't actually in law, but that is what is often agreed. And under UK law, ER is not due on making available. Or you could simply say ER was set up with broadcast in mind and public performance in mind. A stream isn't a broadcast. It definitely isn't a public performance. So why would we apply ER to streams? And obviously, because we didn't have record labels in the room for this hearing, because labels in the main, and not just major labels in the main have lots of issues with the idea that ER should be applied to streaming. And I assume labels will get the opportunity to explain why in future hearings. Although some arguments have already been put into the written submissions to the inquiry. Those were referenced by the MPs. And so one was this, you know, well, EOS for broadcast, streaming clearly isn't broadcast, so EOS should not be applied. Whereas what Tom Fredericks, the lawyer, was saying was, well, you know, as an industry, there's lots of examples where conventions that were set up for one usage of music are then subsequently applied to new usages of music. So the example he gave, which I liked, is the term mechanical rights, which is a publishing term, actually originates in the 19th century when people first started making those self-playing pianos. And the self-playing pianos had the sort of the mechanical rolls that would play music. That was exploiting the song copyright. So the publishers came up with this concept of mechanical rights. Streaming services are paying royalties for exploiting mechanical rights. So something that was developed for self-playing pianos 150 years ago is a principle still applied to streaming. So Tom's point was, in the music industry with music copyright, principles are set up with one usage in mind that are then applied to another usage. So that is not a radical idea. Colin Young, the accountant, pointed out that sort of on the publishing side, on the song side, you could argue it's already happening. There isn't really time here to explain why, but if you read our article in the CME Daily, which is on the website, I kind of explain that in a little bit more detail. Basically, what Tom Fredericks and Colin Young were saying was there is a solid argument for ER being applied to streams. Tom Gray was saying to him, that's a relatively simple solution. I could immediately come up with several complications if you wanted me to, but I'm not gonna. So Tom Gray's argument was, one of the problems of the economics of streaming is, as you already said, it's very complicated. There's lots of different side debates. The danger is everyone in Parliament, all the MPs on the Select Committee, all get really confused and just ultimately decide there's nothing we could do. Whereas Tom Gray's argument was, actually, putting ER on streams will be a simple solution. As I say, it's a simple solution that immediately poses about 17 questions. But in the wider scheme of things, it's a relatively simple solution. So yeah, very much the narrative on the day was, if you want to do something about this, MPs, through Parliament, get government on side so we know it gets through. Let's amend copyright law so that it says that there is an ER payment on streams. And then we figure out how that works. And then artisan. Tom Gray's point was, at the moment, once you've done a record deal, because you've got to recoup any upfront costs, it could take years of streams before you see any more money. Whereas if some of that money was coming to artists through ER, even if they were still then due royalties from the label share, the first stream on the first day, they would get a royalty payment. Even if it was fractions and fractions of a penny, they would get a payment from the first stream, was Tom Gray's argument. So yeah, that was the key takeaway for me from the first of the inquiry's hearings. And it will be fascinating to see what arguments are presented, particularly by the labels down the line. As I say, in my opinion, ER is not quite as simple as perhaps some people think. And my assumption is that those complexities, I mean, I should also qualify. I mean, just because it's a bit complicated is not necessarily a reason not to do it. I mean, lots of things are complicated. And if we didn't solve problems because they were complicated, then we'd never solve anything. So me saying it's complicated doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. But there are some complexities which I don't think were discussed at this week's hearings, and I assume will be raised at subsequent hearings as this inquiry progresses.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what discussions come up at the next hearings in this inquiry and ultimately what happens at the end of it. I mean, we assume that the MP sitting on this select committee will ultimately be fairly sympathetic towards the artists, but select committees don't make law. They only gather evidence. It's for the government to change anything. So the select committee can be as sympathetic as they want to artists. It doesn't necessarily mean that the government won't just ignore all of it. And finally, if later on today, after you've listened to this episode of Setlist, you're sitting there with your phone flipping through videos on Instagram's new Reels with an S feature, and then you get bored of that, and you switch on your TV, and you happen to watch something on US cable TV channel Reels with a Z, you might note similarities between the two names. You would not, however, think that they are related in any way. So says Instagram owner Facebook in its response to a lawsuit filed by that TV channel. Reels, you see, is fun, creative, and social connection orientated, while Reels has a dark celebrity scandal and true crime orientated focus.
Yeah, so this is a new legal filing in an ongoing dispute between Instagram and its owner, Facebook, and the Reels TV channel in the US and its owner, the Hubbard Media Group. So you may remember that Instagram added its Reels feature, Reels with an S, in August earlier this year. They started piloting it in Brazil, I think, last year, but they started rolling out properly this year. It's kind of their TikTok ripoff. I don't know whether or not that's a slanderous thing to say. I don't think it is. I think it's pretty obvious.
It's similar to TikTok, isn't it?
It's pretty like TikTok. In the same way they took stories from Snapchat, because that's what made Snapchat exciting. They've taken this function. They've been inspired. Let's say they were inspired by TikTok.
Sure, and, inspired, yeah.
And obviously from
they might not like that either.
From a music perspective, it's interesting because it formalizes in a way the use of music, other people's music, in videos posted to Instagram. It makes it easier to grab recordings and synchronize them into your video, just like what TikTok does. That's what Instagram Reels does. But when it was launched earlier this year, almost immediately, this US TV network, Reels, so Reels with a Z, said, hey, hang on a second. We're a media company, a video content company, a TV company called Reels. It looks to us like you've just set up a video service, a media service, using the name Reels. And we think you can't do that. And so Reels, the TV company, went legal in August, saying you are infringing our trademarks, you're screwing things up with our name, people are going to get confused. They cited one article in a relatively big publication where they were writing Instagram Reels with the Z, not the S, so they were shouting, there's already confusion. So that was the lawsuit that was filed earlier this year. And then last week, Facebook/Instagram put its response in. Well, the thing that amused me about their lawsuit was at the start, they conceded, I can't remember the exact words they used, but it was like they were basically saying, there's a slight similarity between Reels and Reels. We'll admit that they are kind of similar, you know, like, but I mean, unless you write them down, they are exactly the same. But as you say, Facebook's argument was, okay, they may be kind of similar, but the products are very different. The names, kind of similar, but the products, totally different. Nobody, not one person in the world, could possibly confuse the super exciting Instagram Reels service. I am paraphrasing slightly here, but it was very much in the tone that was in their lawsuit. They were basically saying, Instagram Reels, exciting, cool, cutting edge, and then the TV network Reels is full of tawdry, tabloid-esque, true crime documentaries. No one could possibly confuse those. And here at Instagram, we wouldn't want anyone to confuse it because we wouldn't want to be tarnished by that terrible TV network. I just say, I am paraphrasing there, but that is certainly how I inferred what Facebook had written in their lawsuit.
Yeah, you're only paraphrasing very slightly. I don't think they used the word tawdry, but they did say the fun, creative and social connection-orientated focus of the Instagram Reels feature is the antithesis of the dark, celebrity scandal and true crime-orientated focus of Reels Channel's television programming. Instagram, therefore, has no reason to invite confusion between the two services, and indeed, no confusion has occurred. To prove its point, Facebook went out and surveyed some people out in the real world, and none of them said they were confused. Or at least that's what Facebook says. The lawsuit goes on. People using the Instagram app on their phones who encounter a feature within the app called Reels for creating and editing videos will not think that it is associated with plaintiff's television channel. Consumers watching television through their subscription cable or satellite provider who encountered the Reels channel network will not think it is associated with Instagram's social networking app. Instagram survey evidence alone demonstrates that plaintiffs are unlikely to prevail on their claims.
Yeah, and based on those bold arguments that Facebook, Instagram have put forward, they are saying there is no confusion. It's all nonsense. What are they talking about? And therefore, they would like the judge, at the very least, because Hubbard Media, the company that own Reels, the TV network, were looking for a preliminary injunction in their favour on this dispute. And at the very least, Facebook and Instagram would like that application or motion for a preliminary injunction to be rejected by the court, as you say, because they are pretty confident, based on their survey of some people, that there's no way Reels, the TV network, can prevail in this case, says Instagram, so therefore they definitely should not get a preliminary injunction in their favour. That is the Reels v. Reels litigation, which we will continue to follow because I'm finding it quite amusing.
I'm also imagining it entirely played out on the set of Family Fortunes, Reels v. Reels. There's the survey. We asked 100 people. No one's ever met any of the people who've been asked, but we asked 100 people, and that's how I think. And they should get Les Dennis back to present it. Although it's presumably in the States, and Les Dennis didn't present it in the States.
Didn't Vernon Kay present it in the UK after Les Dennis? Or am I making that up?
Yeah, but we don't talk about Vernon Kay era family fortunes. It's all Les Dennis.
It's also not called Family Fortunes in the US, so American listeners will have no idea what you're talking about. I think it's called Family Feud.
Is it on Reels?
It's not on Reels because it's not.
But which Reels?
It's not tawdry, celebrity-obsessed, true crime documentaries.
Is it fun, creative and social connection orientated? Yes, it is. It must be on Instagram.
I'm going to go and watch the latest edition of Family Fortunes / Family Feuds by opening up the Reels tab on my Instagram app, and I look forward to watching it. Presumably it has to be in 60-second segments. Hey, I think you've taken us on what might be called a bit of a tangent here. The point is, interesting new legal filing in the Reels v. Reels case that we will be watching closely, much more closely than we are watching any iteration of Family Fortunes / Family Feud.
Yes, we wait to see what Judge Les Dennis decides. Anyway, that is the end of this episode of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate, review, and tell all of your friends all of those things. And email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, if you have any questions or comments about anything we've discussed in this episode. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.